question to the Court of Appeals. I see that we have experienced counsel. I assume that you have all received our written instructions. No questions? If either side is going to divide your argument among the attorneys, keeping track of that time is up to you. Otherwise, we are ready for argument in Air Wisconsin versus Hopper.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is David Yoon. My registration number is 23448. I represent Air Wisconsin. Sitting at counsel's table is Don Mark, trial attorney for Air Wisconsin. This appeal involves a defamation claim. The trial court entered a $1.4 million judgment against Air Wisconsin based on a report of suspicious behavior to TSA as required by federal law. This case is vitally important to the airline industry because it involves a federal statute concerning aviation security following 9/11. Because of the novel issue presented in this case, and because of the ramification this court's decision will have on the airline security, both the United States and Regional Airline Association have filed amicus briefs. We ask that this court consider the policy issues that both the United States and RAA have presented. We raised three main issues on appeal. One, whether Air Wisconsin is entitled to immunity for reporting suspicious activity or transaction under a federal statute. Two, whether there was any actual malice to support the presumed compensatory damages and punitive damages. And three, whether Air Wisconsin's report to TSA contained statements that were either substantially true or expressions of opinion. Due to the time limit, I would like to focus our argument today on the opinion issue in the context of Aviation Transportation and Security Act. Unless the court has questions on other issues, I'll rely on our briefs on the remaining issues.
I do have one question, and I'm trying to balance. Your argument is because of the policy, or let me ask this, is your argument because of the policy that you have no duty to investigate when there's a suspicion?
Yes, Your Honor. Our argument is that the, and you can look at the legislative history as well as the United States brief, and it indicates that we are required to report suspicious transaction. By definition, suspicion is a hunch, innuendo, based on conjecture and surmise.
Well, following up that question briefly, and I recognize your time is limited, if your position is there's no duty to investigate, doesn't that render meaningless the actual malice, reckless disregard in the immunity provision? Because if there's no duty to investigate, I mean, the slightest hunch, the merest suspicion, would justify a call to TSA and trigger the immunity. So how do you reconcile those two?
The statute says suspicion. I believe the legislative history indicates that we are supposed to report suspicion. The exception that the court's talking about, I believe, is if we know we're making up false information. If we are completely making up false information, that would be an exception to the immunity statute.
Well, statute also talks about reckless disregard, does it not?
Yes, it says whether you are in reckless disregard for the truth or falsity of the statement. And I believe that is a codification of the New York Times Sullivan standard. And
well, if it is, doesn't that mean that failure to investigate can be an element of weighing reckless disregard?
I believe the courts have said failure to investigate repeatedly. United States Supreme Court has said failure to investigate or negligence is not sufficient to establish actual malice.
Okay.
I have a question about immunity also, Counsel, and I apologize, because I know that you want to focus on something else. But under the airline's interpretation, would it be possible to have a state defamation claim that was not procedurally barred by immunity? And if so, could you sort of point that out?
A state defamation claim?
Yeah.
I believe the Act says that that if an airline reports a suspicious transaction, it shall not be civilly liable to any person under the law of United States or any other state. So I believe that it applies, the Immunity Act applies to all state claims, that all defamation claims.
But there's a balancing that's going on here, right? There's a second part of the statute.
Yes, the exception is what you're referring to.
Right.
And the exception provides that if the disclosure is made with actual knowledge that is false, misleading, or you act in reckless disregard for the truth or falsity of the disclosure, then you are not protected by that immunity.
And how do we ever get to that point in the process where a defamation claim is involved? Procedurally is what I'm asking, if the trial court is required at the very earliest stage of the litigation to make these determinations without hindsight, is what I think I saw.
Yes.
In one of the briefs. How do they ever get there? How does a defamation claim ever survive immunity?
Sure. We filed a motion for summary judgment, and the court had an obligation to make findings, and I would submit that the court just denied this motion for summary judgment without any explanation. So I believe you can employ the summary judgment standard at that stage. But the United States Supreme Court in both said where First Amendment issue is a concern, which we submit that this case involves, the court has to, the appellate court, not only after you go through the summary judgment stage, still has to independently review the record, de novo, to ensure that the jury did not impermissibly intrude on our constitutional First Amendment rights. And so the trial court could employ the summary judgment standard, but nevertheless, I believe this court, even after the judgment, still needs to review the record independently to ensure, and I think that's all laid out in the Bose case and the other Supreme Court cases that we cited. And I believe that is consistent with the Colorado case law, and which plaintiff admits that the standard of review is governed by Colorado law in this case.
Are you asking us to set up a kind of a Trinity hearing? You've argued that the judge should have acted and not sent these issues to the jury. What are you asking us to hold?
We're asking the court on first stage, I believe when an immunity issue is raised, the court has to decide, the trial court needs to decide the matter at its earliest possible stage. And I believe it requires the trial court to make findings, reviewing the evidence that we presented and determining why the evidence allows it to go to the jury. We didn't get that. We submit that we did not get that from the trial judge.
Is it harmless error because the court at the end denied your motion for directed verdict?
The trial judge at the directed verdict stage said two things. One, suspicious transactions not defined, reckless disregard is not defined, and reckless disregard almost always presents a factual issue. And that was I don't think the record, even after the trial, we filed a motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict. The court never reviewed the evidence for itself and said, we feel here's the evidence that supports the matter to go to the jury. And the jury is governed by passion, by a lot of other things. The court needs to scrutinize the evidence to see if our constitutional rights are protected, and that is whether there's actual knowledge of falsity and whether or not we subjectively entertain serious doubt about the truth of the statement. And we would submit to you, if you look at the statement and you look at the facts surrounding the statement, that it doesn't support that. There is no question that there was a policy and statute that says when in doubt, report. It says to report suspicious transaction. There's no doubt that, because in the opening brief, they admit Mr. Hopper had an angry outburst on December 8th. There's no dispute that he used words during this training session, such as, you're railroading the situation, this is a bunch of shit, and talk to, and then cut the training session in the middle. And then plaintiff also do not dispute that he was an FFDO, a federal flight deck officer, who is allowed, authorized to carry a firearm.
Can you point to one fact that creates a reasonable belief that he had his gun with him when he was heading for Dulles?
Oh, sure. He is a federal flight deck officer in and of itself. It says he can carry a firearm in his luggage where nobody will know.
Not that he could do it, that he was doing it. Can you point to one fact creating a suspicion that he was carrying his gun going to Dulles?
I think the fact that he's an FFDO is a concern. But I think the evidence was whether we should have investigated or whether we should have done that. The fact is we did not know. We don't know. He's an FFDO, and we don't know if he has a gun or not. So what's a prudent thing to do in light of the statute? Report suspicious transaction. So what did we do? We reported that he may be armed, and we're concerned about the whereabouts of his firearm. And it's for the TSA to investigate and verify that information. And that is what 9/11 did. It changed the aviation world upside down. It says they formed TSA, they formed ATSA, they federalized aviation security, and they required that TSA spearhead security matters in airlines. And our obligation was to report suspicious activity, and if it turned out to be wrong, that's the risk that the federal government wants us to take, that it is vital for them to have the information so they could determine for itself. Air Wisconsin did not make the decision to bring the airplane back, have them checked, and have them searched. That was not their decision. What we did was we reported what we believed was a good faith belief that there was a suspicious transaction, and it was up for TSA to make that determination. And it looks like I have 2 minutes left. And I am sorry that I didn't get to the opinion issue, but
still time.
Well, why don't I reserve it and then get and I will reserve my time.
Good afternoon, members of the panel. My name is Scott McGath, and seated at council table with me are Jason Reitz and Mr. Bill Hopper, the plaintiff in this case below. A couple of issues I want to address immediately before I get into the issue of opinion versus fact. It seems to me that what I just heard is that this case is one in which the First Amendment rights of Air Wisconsin are at play here. This is not a case in which the statute in any way makes reference to the actual malice standard of the Supreme Court line of cases, beginning with New York Times versus Sullivan and going to Gertz versus Robert Welch. As the court is aware, those largely involve cases of media defendants. Here, there is no application of the First Amendment to what is a private call made under an obligation or a perceived duty to make such a call. Those types of calls to law enforcement enjoy only qualified privileges, and matters of public interest always enjoy qualified privilege. The seminal case on whether or not The First Amendment is going to be protecting this particular commentary by Mr. Doyle is a state law case in Virginia, because as the court correctly pointed out, if there is not a an immunity here because the speech is reckless or made with knowledge of falsity, state law rights remain. And when you look to the Virginia Supreme Court case of Gazette versus Harris, it is a case in which, well, first of all, Your Honors, if we were looking at whether or not there were First Amendment protection, we'd be talking about whether or not this was a matter of public concern, because it clearly is not a matter of a public figure, and Judge McGahee so held.
Do you dispute that this was a matter of public concern?
I do, Your Honor, within the meaning of First Amendment protection. It is a matter of public interest. But even if it were a matter of public concern, and this were reviewable under the standards of Gertz and its progeny, this record is filled with evidence from which the court could make the determination of actual malice. And as the court is aware, the difference between garden variety actual malice, as state laws apply it, meaning reckless disregard, and constitutional actual malice is in the definition of actual malice. And the constitutional definition of actual malice is articulated in numerous cases, but there's a nice articulation of it in the Heart of Hanks Communications versus Connaughton case, 491 U.S. 657. And that is, the defendant must have made the false publication with a high degree of awareness of probable falsity, or must have entertained serious doubts about the truth of his publication. And I submit to you that when you review this case in light of the Hart-Hanks standard, because Hart-Hanks upheld a finding of actual malice, it's one of the cases in which the Supreme Court reviewed it in light of the what they call the constitutional threshold regarding First Amendment, and then found that there was absolutely evidence to support a finding of actual malice. This case, we have actual knowledge that the defendant making the statement, in this case Patrick Doyle, for whom Air Wisconsin has admitted liability, had the requisite degree of awareness that his speech was provably false. And, high degree of awareness of probable falsity, or entertained serious doubts about the truth of his publication. And you don't have to look any farther to his testimony regarding what he said and his defense of the position with regard to the mental stability comment. What Mr. Doyle initially said and testified to at trial and is reflected in the record is, I didn't make the statement. Why didn't I make the statement? Because I lacked the capability to make that assessment. And more importantly, he said we, meaning Air Wisconsin, had those concerns. A review of the record, and by the way, under the state law, going back to the state issue, under the state law in Virginia, the case of Fust, F-U-S-T-E, cited in both briefs, says that that kind of statement, we had concerns about whether it be mental stability or competence, is capable of being proven true or false, because all you have to do is look to the record to determine whether or not we held those beliefs. In this case, the statement the jury found to be defamatory was included, we had concerns about mental stability. No one at Air Wisconsin had those concerns. Scott Orozco testified he didn't have the concerns. Kevin LaWare testified he didn't have the concerns. Bob Frisch, the FFDO, who was involved in this alleged 15-minute security meeting, he testified he didn't have those concerns. That is capable of being proven true or false and capable of defamatory action. So getting back to whether or not this is a matter of public concern, under Virginia law, going back to the Harris and Gazette case, in Gertz, what the Supreme Court said was that in cases involving public concern, we allow the states to set their own rules for compensatory damages, in other words, actual damages. Here, by the way, there is plenty of evidence from which the jury's verdict on damages is supported. We have evidence from a lengthy testimony from Sam Battaglia as to the economic losses the statement caused. We had testimony concerning whether or not Mr. Hoper could obtain new employment by Mr. Holper himself. And then we had testimony from Bob Hulse, an aviation expert, saying that this statement and the consequences of being pulled off the plane would have damaged Mr. Holper's career. But that leads us to the second point, which is important in the Harris case. So let me turn back to that. In the Harris case, because Gertz didn't define who was the defendant designed to be protected by the actual malice, the state court, Supreme Court of Virginia, said that because Gertz didn't do that, we find that the Gertz test does not apply to anyone other than media defendants. And so under Virginia law, the First Amendment protection of public concern does not apply to anyone other than a media defendant. Notably, the court also said that the standard of for public concern does apply in matters of public concern in which there are punitive damages. Here, it was not a matter of public concern. And I want to point to something else. That issue is not even properly before the court. Air Wisconsin argued in its brief that Judge McGahee found that this was a matter of public concern. The citation to the record and the jury instructions do not support that finding. In fact, when you look at the transcript section beginning on page 3630, going to page 3632, Air Wisconsin had tendered an instruction with the heightened standard for public concern. McGahee rejected that standard properly because this was not a matter of public concern. This is no more a matter of public concern than any report to law enforcement. If this were a matter of public concern, we would do away with the issue of qualified privilege. We'd all be talking about matters that are reviewable on, if you report to law enforcement and you made the report and it was false, the person making the statement would be subject to claiming that was a matter of public concern. That's not what this case is about. But even if it were, it's not properly before the court. Air Wisconsin is playing a sleight of hand move here. They are arguing that the judge found this was a matter of public concern, but if you notice, the instructions don't bear that out. The instructions are garden variety, reckless disregard instructions, consistent with the Supreme Court of Virginia's case in Jackson, and And there are two Jackson cases, Government Micro versus Jackson. So this is not public concern speech. And I want to address a couple of other things. And
counsel, I want you to address something too, though.
Certainly.
As you could probably tell from my earlier question, I'm interested in the immunity issue.
Understand, Your Honor.
Why not treat the ATSA immunity like qualified immunity for the government employees and require threshold determinations by the trial court?
Okay.
Up front?
First of all, this is not a qualified immunity case because it doesn't involve state actors. It doesn't involve governmental entities, so it's not applicable. But even if you were applying this, what you do in a governmental immunity case, as the court is aware, you accept all the well-pled allegations as true. And then you look to see whether immunity applies. Here, if you accept that all the well-pled allegations are true, you would assume that this matter was false and reckless. So applying a governmental immunity type analysis here makes no sense. And the exception would swallow the rule, as you pointed out earlier. So that has no bearing here. On that issue, however, Air Wisconsin took the view that Judge McGahee erred as a matter of law when he allowed the jury to determine whether this was a suspicious transaction. Judge Rothenberg raised a good point, which is whether or not that is harmless error. Here it is harmless error. Even if it were a matter of law, and it's not been preserved, I might add, because Air Wisconsin, you'll see the soliloquy about that between myself and Judge McGahee in the transcript. But what you won't see is Air Wisconsin saying, no, you need to make this determination as a matter of law. So that issue's not been properly preserved under Rule 28K. But even if it were properly preserved, that issue's harmless because the exception has been proven. Here we know that the jury awarded punitive damages, which necessarily required a finding of reckless disregard or knowledge of falsity, which is the exception. A nice discussion of this exact type of harmless error is in the government micro versus Jackson case. It had exactly that issue. In that case, it was an issue of qualified privilege, but the court said, well, the court didn't make the mistake with respect to qualified privilege, but even if it did, it was harmless error because the jury made the determination that the exception applied by virtue of the punitive damages rule.
Can I ask about this question I asked your opponent about the duty to investigate? Are we able to get to the malice issue without getting into whether your clients had a duty to investigate?
You're talking about their...
Whether they had a duty to investigate. They're saying we absolutely do not as a matter of policy.
And I think that is a fallacy, and there was conflicting testimony. They were saying that that is the law, and they replied upon Tom Blank's testimony for that. There was conflicting expert testimony in the record from Quentin Johnson. But the answer to your question, Quentin Johnson was our aviation security expert, who said that's nonsensical. And even Blank admitted in his testimony that you have to use common sense. But you can get there from here without even looking at that issue. And that's because when you look at what Doyle did something he knew was false or reckless disregarded whether he knew it was false or true. And the proof is in the pudding there. And, Your Honors, what we know, in addition to the statement he made with regard to mental stability, we also know that he engaged in post-incident cover-up. And the case law is clear. When somebody engages in post-incident cover-up, for example, here, he did two things which are indicative of that. One, he created a completely fabulous story about an event which happened October 14th, which never happened. And we know it never happened because Air Wisconsin would have never trained Mr. Hoper had it happened. That's well set forth in the brief. The second thing he did was he lied in the arbitration testimony. And so even if we were looking at an actual malice standard, we could get there from here, Your Honor. And the Supreme Court in numerous cases has said that although you're looking at what was subjectively believed, you can look at circumstantial evidence to establish what was subjectively believed. Here we have direct evidence, though. We have direct evidence in that Mr. Doyle admitted he wouldn't have said it because he knew it would have caused undue harm as opposed to due harm. If Doyle had the requisite information to make the comment, the harm to Hoper wouldn't have been undue. And those were Mr. Doyle's words, not mine. Those were Mr. Doyle's words, not mine. So in conclusion, Your Honor, when you look at this, you'll see that these are factual statements that are capable of being proven true or false, whether he had a gun, whether we had knowledge of mental instability, and whether he was terminated. And the connotation, which is factual, is proven capable of being proven true or false. The connotation is the man was capable of a heinous crime of air piracy. That absolutely was capable of being proven true or false. And in this case, TSA proved it was not true. Now, Air Wisconsin says that that's the connotation it didn't want. I mean, that wasn't necessarily drawn, but we know it was because its own employees said that that's the connotation that would be drawn if those words were said. Thank you, Your Honors.
Your Honor, I'd like to go through what Mr. McGath just said about capable of being proven true or false. He talked about mental stability. What did we report? We reported that we were concerned about his mental stability. Let's take this example. If I were here and I started shouting at Your Honors and used profanities during the argument, you might question my mental stability. If I were to start shouting, as Mr. Hoper did, that you win, that's it. This is a bunch of shit, and you're railroading this situation. You might report my conduct to the security guard. And if you thought
that I bypassed security downstairs, that the security guard wasn't downstairs, you might be concerned. And you might report that to the gentleman downstairs that you may want to talk to him. We're concerned about his mental stability. That's what we're talking about. We reported suspicion.
Did anybody at the meeting among these four gentlemen specifically say, I am concerned about Mr. Hopper's stability?
They said that he had an angry outburst, Your Honor. That's admitted in their training session.
That was my question. Did anybody at that meeting say to another management manager in Air Wisconsin, I am concerned about Mr. Hopper's mental stability?
They did not use those words, but they described the meeting and what occurred. And plaintiff admits that in their brief, that Mr. Hopper and these comments that I just made to you were, they admit that was used and that that was conveyed to Mr. Doyle. As to how do you form, you hear this, and they draw a conclusion, and they say, wait, we're concerned about his mental stability. He's under the last chance agreement. He's going to be fired. And we don't know whether we should have investigated, whether we should have known. The fact of the matter is, Mr. LaWare made the decision, and he didn't know. He simply did not know whether he was carrying his FFDL firearm. And in the context of what happened in 9/11, in the context of two incidents where two airplanes were hijacked by former disgruntled employees, it's better to be safe than sorry. And that's what we did. And that's, and the jury found, unfortunately, against us based on simply reporting suspicious behavior. And we feel that the court needs to rectify that.
Thank you. We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course. Counsel are excused. Since this was the only case on our docket, the bailiff may announce a recess.
The court will be in recess, subject to call.